It is Saturday, March 3rd, 2012. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz, the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. In the first half of Geek Speak, we'll cover geek news, and in the second half, we'll be taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. So start thinking about what you want to call and ask us or talk to us about. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Trock, so please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. We appreciate his support of the show. If you'd like to make some music, and you do that kind of regularly, for Geek Speak, we'd love to hear your theme and play it. We kind of do a mix-a-match with themes for this show. All right, so if you know what you want to talk to us about, and you're thinking about it, you got it all figured out, then you might want to jot this number, 1-800-655-5877. You have about 23 minutes more to figure out what you want to ask us, and I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation. You want to give out the number more slowly, Miles?
800-655-5877.
That's fantastic. You do need to speak closer to your microphone.
I am terribly sorry.
Thank you so much. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie and corrects me on what I'm doing because, of course, when I'm not here, he hosts the show.
And does a far worse job of it. It's always great to Monday night quarterback.
That's true. You're quite good at the show, actually. And also in the air, I'm laughing away, is Mr. Ben Jaffe. And
laughing away.
Freelance instructor and media guy. Hi.
I'm a freelance laugher.
Yeah?
That's all I do.
Ben, in a second, you're going to tell us about some warp drive problems that you've been having, I'm assuming. But first, I want to let you know that tonight, I'm going to be going to see The Thinning Veil. It's a new play at UCSC by Kirsten Brandt. And this play is way geeky. It's performed in two different venues at the same time. There's three cameras in both locations filming the action and projecting it. There's also three projectors in each space. So it's a very interactive, multi-location piece. And the scenes are, there's two audiences in both, one in each venue. And it's been technically very difficult to do. It's a completely new play. You might have heard about this. This might sound familiar to you because if you listen to the awesome show by my friend Robert Pauly, the Seventh Avenue Project, Sundays at noon, right here on KOSP. Last week, Robert played an interview with the producer Ted Warburton and the director and writer Kirsten Brandt. I highly recommend that interview. But more importantly, tonight and next weekend, the show's going on. If you want to meet me and some friends and such, you're welcome to come to the play tonight. And I'm sure we'll run into each other. It's, again, it's The Thinning Veil at UCSC's theater department. And just to be clear, I do work at UCSC, so I know there might be a little bit of issues. But more importantly, I volunteer here at KOSP doing Geek Speak, as does Robert Pauly. He does the 7th Avenue Project, and you can listen to the interview on the podcast. You can also listen to his show tomorrow. And this is something he sent me. It's one of the most ambitious scientific proposals of all time. MIT neuroscientist Sebastian Sung wants to map the trillions of connections in the human brain and find structures that encode our memories, experiences, and personalities. Many previous researchers have failed in the attempt, but Sung says new technologies may make it possible. He talks to KOSP's Robert Pauly, my friend, about his book Connectrum, How the brain's writing makes us who we are.
Wiring.
Thanks, man. You want to do that one? Yeah. So in any case, new book by a neurologist. Robert's going to interview him. He does amazing interviews tomorrow, Sunday at noon, right here on KOSP. And speaking of live and engaging things, what were you doing in New York, Mr. Jaffe?
I was in New York visiting friends and just having a blast in the Big Apple. And I had a fantastic night where I saw is it Tonight Show, The Late Show, the something show?
Depends on who's in it.
Yeah, I forget what the, anyway, with David Letterman's show.
Oh, okay.
That one. So I saw that one.
That's The Late Show, I think.
The Late Show, I think.
Don't be confused with The Late Late Show.
Or The Tonight Show, or The Daily Show, or The Anything Show. Anyway. So I got to see that taped live. That was fantastic. And then just on a whim, I wandered by Colbert's studios, even though, you know, you're supposed to be there by, I think, 4 p.m. to get standby tickets. It was 5:30. I got the last ticket to Colbert. Nice. The very last ticket. And I stood in the back of the standby line, and I got actually fantastic seats, not the back corner. And I also found myself, I was a nice, like on national TV, I'm a nice 20 pixel by 25 pixel blur. And I screenshotted myself. I'm on screen for about 15 frames.
What episode? What day was it?
It was the one with King something.
You were really prepared for the story, weren't you?
No, not really.
15 frames, but just for the audience, that amounts to basically half a second.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So anyway, I mean, you know, you multiply that together, you get a couple thousand pixels. Like, I was a couple thousand pixels on national TV.
How
Everyone
was the
watches
show?
Colbert.
Was it a good experience? Do they have a good warm-up person?
They have a good warm-up person. Actually, reminds me of my friend Timothy Jordan, except Timothy is a lot nicer in his humor. Love that. And the show was very, very good. It was very good. Like, Colbert, that guy is polished.
Do you get
he
to see
smooth.
Colbert before and after the show
yeah.
as well?
Yeah. He actually came out and did an out-of-character Q&A.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. And one of the audience members raised their hand and said, like, to ask one of the questions and asked, 6 months ago, you were talking with blah, blah, blah in this interview or whatever, and you mentioned Mordor and blah, 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 and, you know, starts going off on Lord of the Rings stuff. And she says, I want to issue a correction that it was actually blah, 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 that blah, 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 blah. And he's like, oh, my God. He starts thinking about it. And everyone's kind of laughing, but he's like totally gets engaged.
He's really upset that he's misquoted.
Lord of the Rings, they go back and forth talking about the intricacies of the inner depths of the story of Lord of the Rings for 5 minutes.
Yeah, one of the things about Colbert is that he did play D&D for a long time. He's right in the geek space.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So anyway, fantastic show. It's amazing how small the room was. Actually, that they fit the
set
into.
Yeah, you can
you
tell
know?
It's kind of small. Yeah.
Well, thanks
for the update from New York and live shows. That's great. And in a minute, you are going to tell us about your warp drive problems.
I got problems.
First, Miles, what's going on with Sony?
Sony has a game, an online card game called Star Chamber, the Harbinger Saga. It's been out for a while. But in the game, it's one of those games where you can buy virtual objects. For example, virtual collector's cards. But they're shutting the game down. Shutting the servers down at the end of this month. And all of those virtual collectible cards that people have paid actual money for, poof, gone.
Oh, interesting.
And it's this interesting aspect of virtual currency, of virtual products that is growing on the net that people are paying actual money for these virtual products, and then once the company goes, it's not profitable for us to maintain this game or this environment or this simulation anymore, gone.
So that's strange.
Go ahead and rotate your mic around, would you? 120 degrees. That you're speaking to the wrong side of it. Do you see that?
That says wrong.
It says no, wrong, wrong. That's why you sound so strange. If you can, that'll work, definitely. Yeah,
there we go.
So,
yes.
Yes. Much nicer.
Thank you. So, I'm assuming that in the EULA of the in-user license agreement that you sign up when you're making
that
this
game, everyone
reads. That everybody reads. The metaphor of a playing card only goes so far as to remind us that it could be a real object, but in reality, you're paying for a service that could end at any time. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that's the trick, is that they're not doing anything illegal because...
Oh, no, they're certainly not doing anything illegal. But although I'm sure there will be some people who will try to sue because they spent real money.
But they're
and
doing
then
something disingenuous. Right, they're trying to sell something that's actually not. Well, I mean, maybe
that's
maybe
the thing
we have to understand is that a virtual thing is a virtual thing.
Yeah, I think that's more the latter, that we just need to understand. Like when you buy stuff online, I bought this extra little bit of bling. I bought this. If it's not a real tangible item that you can take home,
yeah,
you don't really.
Or
have it.
Or if the thing that you're buying, you don't actually get a digital copy that you need to save on your computer that can be read in multi formats. It's not, you know, then it's also like that. I mean, there's, for example, early books on textbooks or books for ebooks were in formats that potentially you can't read even now. There's no player for them.
Right.
So
they had encryption on them, and they were player dependent.
Now, traditionally, trapped and encrypted stuff gets cracked, and over time you get access to it. But that
may or may not be legal, and right, et cetera. Yeah.
And the service model idea is much more profitable right now, much more vast. You know, playing for Bling in Farmville, for example, is a very common tact. And you're really just upgrading a software service that you might not have anymore. Yeah. Does anyone here have old boxed video games like Diablo 2 and stuff on your shelf?
I'm too young. No, I'm kidding.
Right. What's a box?
I just decided to make a youth joke before you guys did. Thanks. You know,
but Miles, do you have old games that you actually paid for? Quake 2, things like that?
Yes.
And you still have the hardware, the box?
The
actual software box.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I keep some of the old ones that I actually paid for when I had physical boxes.
I need to
now
get rid of actually a lot of them, put them just into a simple CD or DVD case, but yeah.
Or an online service, and you put your code in it. Like, that's one of the things I've done with, I think, Diablo. The old Diablo game, I think it was Diablo, I've taken the code and actually put it into Steam, right? And now I can download that game through Steam whenever I want, assuming that they keep providing that service. So now that box is really less and less interesting to me. Of course, also, I never have time for video games, so it's totally
right,
useless.
And a lot of those older games, like, you go back and you're like, oh, this was so great. Wait, I don't remember the graphics being that crappy.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's fat. They're fast. No load times at all.
Assuming you can get that free DOS instance in your virtual machine to run correctly.
Yes. So, Ben, I was recently catching up on some old Next Generation episodes, and I heard that they're remastering the Next Generation series in a Blu-ray volume, and they're doing it from film, which means the quality's better, but they're also redoing all the effects. How do you feel about it?
I'm kind of mixed. I mean, it's kind of like the remastered Beatles music, you know? I mean, do you really need it in pristine, perfect quality? I mean, the point isn't the quality. The point isn't the visual effects. The point is the story. The point is the characters. That's what the Next Generation was for me. That's why I liked the Next Generation more than Voyager, and especially more than Enterprise, and you know, or some of the older movies. Star Trek VI is like brilliant commentary on the social and political scene at that time, whereas the newest Star Trek is kind of vapid in that sense. It's a great action movie, but it doesn't have substance. But the effects are amazing. So, like, I don't know. I kind of feel like if you're going to walk that line, walk more on the, you know, pay for substance than pay for extra visual
effects.
But you're
going to buy it too, right?
No.
Really? Because you're such a Star
No
Trek
way. No way.
Nerd. Okay, well, let's talk about Time Warp. I mean, let's talk about warp drives.
So I've been researching warp drives. I'm actually building one in my basement. I'm going to change my name to Zefram Cochran and, you know,
you're
invent
tall
the first
enough.
One. Yeah, right. No, actually, I think he was two or three inches taller than me. The actor who played the character in Star
Trek
who invented the warp drive, who you see in Star Trek 8 First Contact. Anyway.
And quite a few Next Generation episodes.
Whose name is...
Wait, the actor?
The name? The actor of the name of the actor? I have no idea.
Oh, no, I thought you were going to do the name of the character.
Well, Zefram Cochran.
Yeah. Okay, sorry.
But the name of the actor...
Miles.
Yeah, go on.
I'm a software engineer. I'm tired.
We'll talk about that in a minute.
We'll get to that. So yeah. Basically, the technology, the thing I like about Star Trek is a lot of the technology that they talk about actually seems fairly feasible, at least to a certain level. Like, they make it fairly, at least pseudo-plausible, faux-plausible. And so the technology behind this is, because you can't travel faster than light, they decided to explain it basically using the same principles of an Alcubierre drive. That's French.
Alcubierre drive, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Which is basically you create a warp bubble. You create, you contract space in front of you. You expand space behind you. So you end up with a no net change in the space-time continuum around yourself, just localized changes.
Oh,
which
is that
allows
all?
You, that's it. Which allows you to actually move through space at sub light speed, but move through more space, so you get the effect of moving faster than
This is similar to when we talk about the universe expanding. By the way, if you greatly let's keep on pushing Robert's show. Robert's got Robert Pauly's show, the 7 Heavy Project on the podcast, has a couple episodes that talks a lot about space. He's very interested in Einstein's theories of relativity and general relativity. And this idea that this, you know, the universe is expanding, and it is expanding faster than light travels. Therefore,
at the outer fringes.
Yeah, far enough away. Therefore, there's always a separation. But that's because the space in between the stuff is actually getting larger. It's not that anything's actually traveling faster.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in
our observable universe is actually shrinking. Because if you
look
far enough away, then you see light, you would see light that's from a point in the universe which is traveling away from us faster than the speed of light. Oversimplification of white lie, but...
It's not shrinking. It's expanding. It's just becoming more limited.
What? Ooh, good. Yeah.
Good point.
Ooh,
fantastic.
Go on, Ben.
Okay, let's track this back.
Yeah, but we're talking about warp drives.
Like,
let's get more practical here.
Eight steps back to warp drives. So
you modify space to go faster. Go on.
So these researchers from the University of Sydney have been doing some number crunching, and they found that if you were to use this, I'm not going to say the French name again, this theory.
I don't think you said it the first time.
Thank you, Miles.
He inferred it.
just interpolate over my...
Go on.
Bleh. If you were to manage to solve the problems necessary to get yourself into a warp bubble and then to get yourself out of a warp bubble, the people who you were visiting, assuming you were going to another planet to visit your friends, they would be dead because... You dropping out of warp would blast them with gamma radiation and high energy particles, and they would be obliterated, completely obliterated.
I see.
Isn't that nutty? That's crazy.
As opposed to, like, if you turn the other direction, or, like, you know, we're off.
I think it's probably a radial effect.
Yeah.
Well, actually, so that's interesting.
I mean, that's what the deflection dish is for.
So this number crunching is really, really difficult. And so in their research, they didn't actually crunch the numbers for all the area around where you come out of the warp bubble, just immediately in front of. So conceivably, you could kind of aim a little bit off to the side of the planet you're going to visit, and you might be okay, but you might not. They just didn't crunch the numbers for that.
Maybe there's some more numbers to crunch we don't know about warp technology. And actually, you get to conserve that energy in there for you.
Well,
and put it in your antimatter chamber.
From what we know right now, which is
rabbit hole of geekdom.
Yes, anyway. Yes. The other thing that's really interesting about this, so basically the reason that they would be blasted because of like with the gamma radiation and high energy particles is because space isn't actually empty. So as you're traveling through space, imagine it almost like a surfer wave kind of thing. As you're traveling through space with this crazy warp bubble and you're hanging out inside the warp bubble, not moving inside the warp bubble, you're almost surfing through space. But a lot of the stuff that you go through, a lot of the particles that are hanging out in space get sucked up into this warp bubble too. And so the longer you travel, the more stuff ends up in your warp bubble and the more stuff gets jettisoned out the front when you arrive at your destination.
Awesome.
Or jettisoned out or whatever.
James Cromwell.
Ooh, James Cromwell. Yes, that's right. He also played the farmer in Babe the Gallant
you
Pig.
Bet.
Or no,
that's,
Babe. I think
James Cromwell has been the supporting actor in so many things. Like, he's that guy who's the supporting actor.
He is. Never mind. I thought he played Odin.
He was nominated for an Academy Award for the Best Supporting Actor in Star Trek First Contact, L.A. Confidential, The Green Mile, The Sum of All Fears, The Artist, and the television series 6 Feet Under also has his nomination. And he's nominated for an Oscar and 3 Emmy Awards.
So
he's a pretty...
He's got a very distinctive voice. I remember watching an old Deep Space Nine episode and going, that's James Cromwell. Just from hearing it.
Yeah, that's true.
But let's go on to the geek news.
Just going to say I'm a little offended. He was not a supporting character in Star Trek First Contact. He was the inventor of the warp drive.
Ended up being a supporting character.
Darn it. Okay, fair enough.
Miles, what's your next news story, sir?
The Japanese are... really amazing people with regard to the gadgets that come out of that country. This one is a speech jamming gun.
Huh? How does that work?
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, you have it with you?
No.
Okay.
So what goes on is you have this handheld device that has a directional mic on it, and you point it at someone.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're thinking it's noise cancellation, no, it's not noise cancellation.
Oh, man.
It does, however, work out to maybe 30 feet.
Okay, but you put a microphone on somebody.
Okay,
and then you report it to the Chinese government. Right, the Japanese government's in pretty good condition right now.
There's latency there.
Yeah. I do want you to understand the concept here. So imagine, if you will, that you are on a Skype call.
Okay.
And your mic is picking up the audio from the other side.
Yes.
And so you get a doubled echo effect.
Yes.
How easy is it to maintain that conversation with the echo?
Well, that's really funny that you should mention that. It's one of the problems we're having with The Thinning Veil, the play that's at UCSC that I'm going to tonight. Exactly one of the problems is a delayed soundtrack. It depends on the volume level.
Right. So what
when
happens
I was in
is...
Science Club with Preston Q. Boomer.
you were school. Just a name dropper today, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. Come on. One of the things that we did in initiation process of the Science Club was to have to repeat an oath, which I could do right now, but I won't bore you, while listening
Thank
to yourself
you.
In a 10-second or 4-second delay. So something long, a certain duration, depending on the duration, it makes it very difficult to speak. So that's what it does?
It has a directional mic and a directional speaker. And if, for example, someone is speaking too loudly in a library there were some other effects, too. They were saying, like, if someone is taking too much time in the conversation. I mean, this could be used for abuse. But the idea is that you say something, and then 2.5 seconds later,
you hear it again.
And so you're trying to do that. speak it. And, yeah.
That's very cool. And probably loud with a directional speaker. Probably a
yes.
Ultrasonic directional speaker. Very cool.
2.2 seconds.
0.2 seconds?
Is it 0.2 seconds?
0.2 seconds.
Well, there's also the distance, so...
Ooh, but that's interesting. I mean, I wonder how close you want
feet,
to be.
Sound travels pretty fast.
The optimal duration would be very interesting. Okay, so I've got all the gear at work to do this. We got to make one of these.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, here's a question. If you're trying to silence people, would it be more difficult to silence people who regularly do webinars? Because they're constantly hearing themselves fed back. Like,
people that are trained to speak.
I mean, I've thought about that because
I silence people. I just go on. Sorry. No, I'm not going to do that.
I'm not engaging. You're going to just turn off my mic.
I was. What's up with coffee? You don't drink coffee, do you, Ben?
I do. I do.
I thought you didn't.
Mm-mm. I love coffee. But I don't drink it enough that I get addicted. I never want to get addicted.
You also don't drink it in space.
I don't. Why do you ask?
Well, I was wondering if people do drink coffee in space, actually.
Oh, funny you should ask. Well, that was backwards. There is an episode on Physics Central called Bistro Nuts, and this is talking about drinking coffee in space, on the International Space Station, out of cups.
Why out of cups?
Well, because
who drinks coffee out of a straw?
Who drinks coffee out of a straw?
Out of a bag?
Also, I think the coffee they have probably tastes terrible. But
wait. So how do you drink in microgravity? How do you drink from a cup?
This is really, really interesting. Before I watched the video, I was no way.
So let's visualize context. You have no effective gravity on anything.
Yeah, you're in microgravity.
So you have liquid. So let's just assume that somehow you were able to get liquid to be kind of in a cup. So now you want to put it in your face. So the problem is, to do this, you have to use some kind of perceived force. One way to do this would be to accelerate the cup slightly towards your face, then hold on the cup and let the contents continue going. And what you would have is a lot of coffee on your face.
Yeah.
So
let's eat it slowly, and then it came out, and you can just kind of like sip at the big sphere. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how it is. But then we didn't even address how to get the coffee.
It's so funny. In all my life, I've thought, wow, what would it be like to be in space? And I thought, if I were in space, I could probably do this. But no, in fact, it's not that way. It's like everyone's believed that they're super awesome, but we're just humans. Yeah, yeah, we just get nauseous and have a horrible time. Anyway, what they do is if you imagine like a coffee cup, like a normal coffee cup, but it's made of plastic, and instead of it just being perfectly round, it's shaped kind of like a teardrop. Okay. If you're looking down on it, it's like a teardrop. And yeah, the top is open just like normal. So it just kind of looks like a teardrop shaped coffee cup if you're looking down on it.
Instead of the teardrop point, though, you have an opening.
Yeah, and technically in microgravity, there is no down.
It's like
just sand.
Yeah.
perceived down. So all you have right now, now what we have is a droplet looking.
You have a droplet looking normal.
And specifically a drop that is attached to something. Because if you have a drop of water that's not attached, it's a sphere. So this is kind of like a teardrop effect.
Oh, let me start over. So
you know what? We're going to continue this conversation in just a second. But first.
that's a relief. We'll get to continue this.
Geeks Beyond QSB supported by Bay Photo Lab. And in addition to in-store photo kiosks, Bay Photo offers online ordering of photo products, including prints, books, boxes, albums, metal prints, and specialty photo items. Details at bayphoto.com/local. You can call us with questions and comments right now. We are waiting to take your call. Rick's in the other room, ready to answer the phone. The phone number is 800-655-5877. Again, that's a toll-free number, 1-800-655-5877. And if you didn't get that those two times, don't worry. I'll say it a couple more. We're also supported by Cruzeiro Internet. Cruzeiro powers broadband, DSL, and websites for thousands of local homes and businesses. Cruzeiro Internet technology for the next 20 years. More information online at cruzeiro.com. We are taking calls, and the people in the air room is Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. The phone number to ask us anything you'd like is 1-800-655-5877. The Geek Bit this week is something. What we're doing with Geek Bit now, we're going to try to modify it, maybe label a little bit better. I just made this up, so Miles, if you don't like it, let me know later. Geek Bit, something that is cool but not so cool for radio, right? So it's something you got to watch, something you got to experience. And a listener, Robert from Aromas, California, suggests we all watch the recent TED Talk on some awesome aerial robots. Now, we've seen these aerial robot stuff before. There's a TED Talk. It's at least 12 minutes long because 12 minutes in, he says it gets really cool. And we'll link to that from geekspeak.org.
Do they drink coffee?
I don't know. I don't think they're all – they also don't work in no gravity.
Oh, aerial. Not...
aerial, yeah, not micro gravity. We're also supported by Dr. Hey Genry.
Good said.
Yeah.
Take two.
Oh, right. Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. Information is online at RamirezDDS.com. The phone number, one last time, call us anything about any technology you'd like, 1-800-655-5877. Ben, teardrop space cups.
Go on. So you have a coffee cup. You take a coffee cup, put it on the table. And then instead of it being round as you look down on it, it's shaped like a teardrop, okay? There's no special, nothing different about it, just that it's shaped like a teardrop. So it's got this angle here.
A teardrop angled away from you. So the tip of the teardrop is going away from you?
The teardrop is actually...
Okay, stop for a second.
Look straight down at
We don't have good terms for a teardrop. So let's assume that a teardrop is a slightly modified cone with a round bottom. Cone with a round bottom, is that good enough for a teardrop shape?
I think so. Okay. I'm having trouble visualizing what you're saying. No, I'm kidding. Okay. Anyway.
A cone with a rounded bottom. Well, is the cone pointing up or sideways?
It's pointing sideways.
Thank you. Go on.
But there's no sideways in space, Miles. anyway, okay, so all this heck.
And it's bisected. The cone is bisected in the vertical, yes?
No.
To have a volume, you have to have some opening. So the opening is the side of it.
Okay, so we'll put the link up on geekspeak.org.
Geek Bit is what it should have been.
When you see it, it'll make a lot of sense.
How do you get the
right?
Anyway,
so when you see it, as opposed to on radio when you can't.
The point is, go on, Ben. I'm very curious now. How does that help?
Well, basically you have this acute angle, mm-hmm. which is that point of the teardrop or the... raindrop or whatever, right. And the water will actually siphon up the acute angle to the top, and then you can just sip it out of the angle part.
Very cool. So because of the surface area of the liquid, it's going to find that kind of funnelly spot, mm-hmm. if you will. Very
yep. Cool. It's pretty cool. I'll put the link up.
Surface area or surface tension?
Surface tension.
Did I say surface area?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Surface tension.
Yes.
Yeah. The surface area wants to get smaller.
Wow, I'm just being the total pedant this episode, aren't I? As opposed to every other episode.
We are waiting for calls with questions and comments about technology. We can answer anything you'd like. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. And while we're waiting for the calls, Miles, your next news story.
To follow up on a story we've had in the past about AT&T and their unlimited iPhone plans where they were throttling users, you know, at a mm-hmm. what was considered by many to be too low a level. individual who was an unemployed truck driver and student took AT&T to court, to small claims court, and he won. And he got $850.
Oh, that's cool.
Because they were throttling him at a much lower level than even the same price for the 3 gigabyte plan, which is also, you know,
interesting.
So it's the same price.
How did he, have the information to tell the court? I mean, how do you argue that point? Was he a geek?
I don't know.
Interesting. I was just wondering, like, what kind of... It's a pretty technical question.
Is it, though?
Well...
To say that they throttled me after 2.1 gigabytes and...
He'd have to be mapping the traffic pattern to say that it was throttling. It might have just been
no,
a slow network.
No, AT&T will actually show you... you can go up to their site and track
and
how much data you were using.
Oh, okay, interesting.
And as who knows if it's as a result of this or just because of public outcry, but AT&T has raised that throttling threshold. In other words, the point where it gets much slower to 3 gigabyte on the unlimited plans. Yeah, 3 gigabytes on unlimited.
This is the plan that you and I are on.
Yeah, but.
Just the term is going to...
Yeah.
Why? Is 3 gigabits small? Is that small?
No, it's the fact that 3 gigabytes is not the same as unlimited.
But isn't it just... It just throttles your speed. And the unlimited refers to how much data you can do.
Right.
Right.
Now,
so they never talk about in the unlimited fast it is.
And if you're throttling speed, like cutting your speed by half every megabyte, then how fast are you getting your stuff past the 3 gigabyte?
You don't go very fast after you get to 3 gigabyte. Is that what it is? You're talking about there's a certain amount of data you can do with the unlimited plan. A certain amount of data
that is unthrottled.
It's unthrottled. It's basically as fast as you want to do it. For the first 4 days, you listen
as fast as AT&T can provide it. Yeah.
You watch as much YouTube videos and listen to as many streaming episodes of Geek Speak as possible in the first 4 days. Then you've used up the 3 gigabyte unlimited part of your plan, and now it gets throttled down so small that you. Theoretically, you watch the rest of the entire month as much as possible. You still won't double that. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I don't know. It would be a case-by-case basis. And what AT&T has stated is that they only really throttle when their network is under heavy usage.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, with the advent of the iPhone and Android phone, it's always...
I'm curious if it's a situation where they look at their customer base, they go, well, these are the people that are paying us more money, and therefore we're going to make sure their service is better, so we'll throttle the other customers. I mean, is it that kind of level, or are they doing it much more? I mean, I would kind of assume that they try to balance everybody's throttle gets lower.
No,
it's not like
on
they're
the
looking
contrary.
At different
no,
users.
On the contrary. If you have one of the plans, like a 3 gigabyte plan or a 200 megabyte plan, whatever thing you're on, if you go over, you are charged for those overages.
Right.
Whereas unlimited, you get past, you know, a certain point, and rather there is no point where you get charged more.
Right. So that customer pays you less, therefore it's less important. I mean, I can see why AT&T is doing it. So I'm glad that
he
won a court.
Up to the 3 gigabyte
point,
they're not paying less.
Right. Good point. Let's go ahead and start taking some calls here on GeekSpeak. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments about technology, you're welcome to do so. We are taking calls from listeners all over the world. And let's start first in Long Beach, California with Scott. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I called you guys before with this problem a couple months ago, and it's kind of morphed into something different now. I called you because when I would do a right-click and open up a menu, it would just start flickering like crazy, and it would be across like all apps that I was running. You'd do it on the Quicken. You'd do it when I'd open up the little calculator on Quicken, and I figured out it was with Safari. If I turned Safari off, it went away. So I made the mistake of doing a Windows 7 troubleshooter to try and like auto-fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I opened up Safari again, like on Facebook, there are no posted photos. They're just boxes. They're blank. And on some of the other websites, I guess they're using some kind of an image as a header, and that's gone. So basically, I can get the data, but I don't get any images at all.
And this is just in Safari?
Excuse me?
And this is just in Safari on a Windows 7 machine.
Right. Right. So I switched over to Chrome, but I really like Safari because I just like that, you know, how you can display the websites and
sure.
the little images. And
I'm going to guess from the description, it sounds like it's probably some kind of caching problem with Safari. Safari's having trouble writing its cache. That seems to make sense to me. Miles, you got any ideas on this? You're a programmer.
I'd have to see the machine.
Like, yeah. I mean, you have uninstalled. You've uninstalled Safari and you reinstalled it, right?
I did. Yeah.
Have you tried
uninstalled it? And you know, when I reinstalled it, it came back up with all my favorites and everything preloaded, like it was never uninstalled at all.
So, have you tried emptying your cache, and have you tried running Reset Safari and clearing as much of that as you can afford to clear?
Running the cache, as far as how would I do that?
So I only know how to do it on Mac, but I'm sure it's fairly similar on Windows, which is somewhere in some menu, probably the file menu, or if there's a Safari menu.
In the preferences area.
Yeah, or in the preferences area.
Which is usually like tools, options, or edit preferences, something like that.
Yeah, there should be an empty cache button somewhere. And if you can't find that, you can try clicking on Reset Safari. There's probably a button for that as well. And that'll let you clear all kinds of things like your history, your top sites, your bookmarks, your cache. And some of that, obviously, you don't want to clear. But some of it, you can afford to clear.
I have done that back when it was flickering. It kept flickering. But I'll try that again. I know what you're talking about because I did do that.
I also think that Safari on the Windows machine, on the Windows platform, is just not a very good... I mean, I'm not real convinced that Apple can make really good Windows software, because the Windows software I've played with that's from Apple had these kind of problems. Like iTunes on Windows, I've always had trouble with, but on a Mac, it's great. It's like their user, their programmer base is just not as strong in Windows or something. It seems kind of strange.
Yeah, it crashes a lot when I first started up, but once it's up and running, it seems to run real nice. But lots of times when I first started up and I go to open up that first web page, it just stops and... You know, Windows shuts it down, and then I have to start it up again. And
yeah, this sounds like a writing file problem to me. It really does, because you know, we talk about viewing stuff online. We're actually not viewing anything. We're copying everything to our local computer and then displaying it. Right? It's always a download and copy. Even streaming content's copying it to your computer. So what's probably happening is something is strange in the way it's installed. And I would attempt. I don't know a lot about Windows, unfortunately, but I would attempt to uninstall Safari and then delete everything about Safari. Like try to get rid of its preference files. Try to get rid of its settings. Look in the registry. Does Windows 7 still have a registry? It has to, right? Try to delete it. And the reason, but be careful because you can really mess up your registry if you do that.
Yeah.
Because the reason is it's very possible that the way it was first installed, some version of Safari that you got since you've been an early adapter on Windows, installed its caching or its preferences in a certain location, which is now having trouble. And it could be that the file path that it chose or that Windows gave it as a temporary file path was bad, but it keeps on using that same space. It's also possible that Safari, for some reason, is showing a problem with your hard drive and that you actually have a physical problem that just seems to be manifesting this way. When you have write problems with files, it's extremely important to make sure that your drive is stable. That's just something I normally do.
From the time I bought this computer, only in Safari.
So it's probably just a Safari, the way that they set up the preferences the first time. The thing is, uninstalling and reinstalling does not mean that you've lost any of those settings. Those things might still be in the same place from the first install. And so I would try to get rid of the location that it's in and then start afresh so that it can do it from the new defaults that Apple's providing with Safari. Good luck, Scott.
All right.
I love that you called back and let us know how things went and how you fixed it and all that. That's wonderful. I always get a call back from people, so thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ed from Aptos, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, guys. How you doing today? This is your other caller. This is your other listener.
Thanks.
I thought I'd try something instead of asking a question. I thought I'd just bring up a topic for a conversation. You guys can just add on to it. It's something I never hear anything about. I'm an engineer. It's always been something I've liked researching, and it's called personal automated transportation or personal automated transit. In Morgantown, West Virginia, is one of the only automated personal automated transit systems in the country. It's at the University of West Virginia, and they've run it from the university into town. And it's to me, it's a bit oversized. The cars they use, they decided to make these cars that can handle 15 people standing up.
Oh, interesting. So
easily can handle people.
And these are not railed vehicles. These are autonomous.
They're on rails.
They're on rails, okay.
But it's totally run by computer.
Mm-hmm.
Up until late 90s, it was actually run by a tiny, tiny old PC.
Oh, neat.
And the software definitely needs some upgrades. Like, I don't think they still fix something that happens on a regular basis
with
any fault in the system.
So how have you been? Have you been researching this stuff? Or are you thinking of this for your...
I've been researching this for years. I'm heavily into it. And a lot of people are against it, or people just don't know how much simpler their lives would be and how much less costly transportation would be if we were to go to and automated transit systems. You think about the size of roads, which are because of the size of cars.
Well, you know, you know about Google's endeavor in, is it Arizona that they actually got?
Nevada.
Nevada, that they got legislation to allow for robotically piloted vehicles. These are actually cars, just regular cars without a human driver, which are now legal in. But you're talking about small.
That doesn't help.
Right. You're talking about small shared space. So it's not really personal automated transit. It's small automated transit with multiple users. That's the stuff you're interested in.
That's just related to DARPA's program. That doesn't cut down the size of the vehicle itself. If you think about the size of the roads, the size of a car, your car is as big as it is. Because you don't know how much space you're going to need to carry what you're going to need to carry that day. You don't know how many passengers you're going to have. You then have extra security features because you're driving on roads where you don't know what can happen. The power plant then is oversized, which increases the weight much more. So the thing is heavily oversized and uses a ton of fuel that isn't needed. There are a bunch of different personal automated transit designs in progress, and one I would propose would actually be able to use various kinds, like people can think about Disney World, Disneyland. They have the monorail. That's a type of personal automated transit, even though they have drivers on a number of their lines. It can be fully automated.
Hey, Ed, we have like four other listeners calling in, so you might be listener two, but we've got a few more we want to get to. It's an interesting space. I get the idea that if you actually design the vehicle really successfully for carrying people, you do not need the kind of mass you need for each individual for cars. Just really quick question for you. Why we call it personal in the sense that you're sharing the environment with multiple people? Personal would be a taxi or a bicycle. But if you're doing it with, 12 people standing in the vehicle, why is it called personal?
Well, public transportation has the connotation of bus and train size.
Uh-huh.
Personal can mean one person per vehicle. It can be as small as you fit your briefcase or your grocery bag and you in a vehicle, and that's it.
Right. So you're talking about a very and the reason you can take advantage of this is because you have a highly automated, efficient system where you have multiple vehicles on the same types of tracks, and the systems are actually handling the complexity of using that track successfully with multiple users. That's very cool. I think we're going to see more of that kind of stuff. Of course, an infrastructure with a rail system, especially a new type of rail system, would be very problematic. But I need to take other calls. Thank you, Ed, for the call.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, I really, really briefly, I want to say I'm unfortunately not so optimistic that we're going to see it, at least in the U.S., because of the difficulties in creating an infrastructure like that. And more importantly, creating the perception in the public that we need it.
Well, the thing that's interesting to me is that public transportation, I don't avoid public transportation because of other people. I don't mind that at all. I like being around other people. Mm-hmm. That's not a big deal. The issue for me is the duration it takes for me to get to my destination. You know, I have very limited time to do the different tasks in my life. And one of the things I do is I compress my transit to a point that only really a personal vehicle works. And that's ridiculous, right? That I design my life that way. But
here's a thought. I mean, if you had fully automated systems, they could be a lot more efficient than you driving. They could be faster. And you wouldn't have as much traffic because you would be able to route traffic a lot better.
Absolutely. What I'm saying is I can get to my location, to my two locations, my multiple locations in the same type of time or just 10% longer, I'd totally do public transit. Yeah. I'd do non-controlled transportation. Yeah. Absolutely. Non-personally controlled transportation.
Well, one thing we know about human beings is they're very bad about long-term investments. So.
That's true. From Felton, Kevin, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, hi. I've got this new Macintosh here. It's got mail, and I really dislike mail.
Yeah, why?
And I'd like some advice about what email program to try. I don't want to use any Google software because I don't like being tracked or being told what restaurant I should go eat in and so on. So I'd like an entirely private email program that I can control.
I just started using an application comparable to Apple Mail called Postbox. Postbox available, I think, on Windows as well as Mac, so it's interesting to everybody. I don't actually know how much it costs. I'm using the demo. It's probably under $100. I'm not really sure. I like it a lot, but it's very similar to Mail and maybe Thunderbird, which is a free email client from the Mozilla Foundation.
Didn't they make Eudora? They updated Eudora or something?
Eudora, I think, is dead on the vine at this point.
They might have updated it recently. I haven't heard much word about it.
Yeah, it doesn't run on 10.7. That That was what I used for years, and I liked it.
So if you like Eudora...
Okay, I'll try Postbox.
If you like Eudora, I don't know if you'll like Postbox. But you do have a month-long use for it. The one thing that's really important about mail clients is if you're using POP and you're actually copying all the mail locally, you have a very different problem than if you're using an IMAP client, because the storage media for all your mail, which is locally to your computer, is proprietary to the email client you were using. Ben, do you have something to say?
Yeah, yeah. I had another suggestion, which is Sparrow.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's a Mac-only application. It doesn't cost very much. It's somewhere between $0 and $50. Somewhere in the middle.
So you use Sparrow?
I use Sparrow, and it's a little bit different. It kind of almost looks like a lot of those applications for Twitter.
Yeah.
It almost looks like that. It kind of forces you to take a little bit of a different approach to your mail.
Yeah.
But see, I really, really like it a lot.
And I was remiss. While the proprietary Eudora software is no longer being maintained by Qualcomm, there is a Eudora open source edition.
Ooh, interesting.
People have taken basically the Mozilla Thunderbird base and then put a Eudora facade in front of it.
Yeah.
So that if you're used to the old Eudora interface, then this may be the way you go.
Eudora had a very different kind of find feature. It had really good filtering processes, and it had the idea of windows per folder. So if you were doing a lot of filtering.
The find function was great. It was really powerful and effective. I could always locate something.
You might want to try Eudora open source edition. So the, if you do a Google search for that, all the Yahoo search, Bing
search.
We'll have
it up on geekspeak.org after it shows up.
I'm not that afraid of Google.
Yeah, good.
I want to run their software.
Don't forget
it. One other little question. This thing is a MacBook Air. It has this Thunderbolt drive. Bus, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that just to run an external monitor, or is it going to be capable of anything else in the future? Is anybody talking about
it's
that?
It's FireWire's replacement as well.
Yeah, basically that.
So it will connect to FireWire at some point?
Yeah, it supports daisy chaining as well, so you can support, you can plug multiple devices and chain them to each other, just like you could with FireWire 400 or 800.
Right, but it doesn't connect to FireWire, right?
Right, you need a connector box, an adapter box.
Have you seen an adapter box that does that?
I thought they
were going to built-in drives that just had Thunderbolt attachments.
That is the case, but I think they're also making adapters for that.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I haven't seen that yet. Has anybody here seen multiple monitors on Thunderbolt?
It is possible. It's not supported.
Okay. So this is the thing
so
about
Apple
Thunderbolt.
Says no.
This is the thing about Thunderbolt. It feels like they released it before there was anything there. I was recently looking at external drives, and I tried to find one, and even to find out if my laptop could support it, because it has a Thunderbolt, it has a DisplayPort adapter, and I couldn't find enough information to find out if it would work. So it's a promise, but not a fulfillment yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll see what happens.
My impression when they were selling it, the salesman was very vague about what the...
And we're all still vague about it.
Yeah, it's because they don't know.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. That was Kevin from Felton, and we are going to now take...
I was at an Apple store, actually, and I asked the guy about Thunderbolt and had this ridiculous conversation with him. And then at the end, he offered me a job because I knew more about it than he did because I had done a bunch of research. So it's like...
From Freedom, California, Alicia, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, thank you. So I have a question. I'm going to, I guess, take you guys back a little bit. I have an 8-year-old grandson. He's very interested in space and astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've taken him lots of fun places, like around the Bay Area, like... the Tech Museum, the Planetarium.
The Exploratorium?
Exploratorium. Academy of Science has a planetarium. And
Chabot.
Went up to Hiller Aviation Museum in San Carlos. So I'm wondering, do you guys know of any other maybe like lesser known destinations that are cool for kids to go
Miles,
to?
Miles, have you been to Chabot?
What's Chabot?
Chabot. It's a... science, a lot of heavy on astronomy as well.
Well, there you go. Miles
Observatory. Yeah, Skyline Boulevard. I believe that's the one. Yeah, I just found a picture. Yeah, that's the one that I went to as well. And they have a phenomenal planetarium exhibit. And I went and I talked to the guy who was running it, and they actually, all of the, on the IMAX screen, all of the imagery that they calculate is actually calculated on the fly. So the guy is actually holding a little joystick and he's zooming around the universe like that. It's pretty cool.
You know, the other thing, Alicia, I would suggest is that he should join an astronomy club, right? There's a lot of astronomy clubs where people get up their telescopes and get up on a mountain, and people are, if they've set up their scope and they've get ready, they are happy to let other people look at it and talk about it and talk about it. And that's really the, if you're interested in astronomy, especially stargazing aspects of it, and, you know, tracking objects and that kind of thing you can do on your own, I would highly recommend finding one of those groups and joining and take him up into a cold night up on a hill.
Okay.
Also, if he enjoys reading, Bad Astronomy is a pretty good blog. He blogs about all kinds of stuff. And
it's a little higher than an 8-year-old would.
It is higher, but I mean, you know.
Older.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, it depends. He might find it interesting.
That might be interesting to do together.
Yeah. You'd like that. I mean, Bad Astronomy is a great blog. Yeah.
It's easy to read if you don't know very much, but it has all the details if you do know.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, I think we're going to take one more call from Salinas. David, welcome to GeekSpeak. I think maybe David is on line 6 now. Let's try that. David, are you here with us now?
I am here with you now.
What's your question?
I have a question about non-Newtonian fluids.
And okay.
The question is, I've seen the experiment on an episode of The Big Bang Theory. I've seen it on a couple of YouTube videos where you take a non-Newtonian fluid, something like cornstarch mixed with water, and you put it into a speaker cone, and then when sound's applied, it creates vertical development. And I was trying to determine, is it the decibels, the waveform, frequency?
It's the frequency.
What causes?
It's the frequency. Well, you've got to have enough amplitude to excite the molecules, but it's the frequency that is actually causing the shape.
So would a low frequency, like a bass, be better for doing that?
No, I think the frequency, depending on the type of fluid, is the issue.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know. It's definitely an experiment. But you don't have to have a lot of a movement to get it to work. So you can definitely try with any speaker cone. We'll actually do it to some degree. Thank you for the call. I interesting subject. I love new materials.
Thank you.
Thanks. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Complete Mailing Service, located in Harvey West Business Park. Complete Mailing Service, pushing the envelope for Santa Cruz County since 1976. 425-5556 or online at completemail.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. Everything we talk about on GeekSpeak after the show, we put up a little show page about it. We have links and videos and all that stuff. So if you want to know more, go to geekspeak.org. We actually also sometimes forward promote shows very infrequently, but we will be here every week. I also want to let you know that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence. It's actually just by David Lawrence. I don't think he has the show Online Tonight. It's just David Lawrence. We'll have to figure that out. Anyway, he's the puppet master on Heroes, or was before he died, I think. This is
the character.
The character.
Not
the
person.
Right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
That's an important point.
And every time I say, oh, your character died, he goes, no, it didn't. So it's always back. Anyway, Miles, Ben, Rick, thanks for being here today with me. Stay tuned now for Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers.